Okay, Alan Seymour talking to Frank Hall on the 8th of November 1999, and Frank is continuing his memoirs from the war years.
In the year 1941, because of optical deficiency, not mental deficiency, just optical, I was called up for National Service in munitions. At that time I was employed by F.T. Sims, the wireworks in Ramsbottom, as a standards inspector, in other words, quality control in today's jargon. And I was transferred from inspection work at F.T. Sims to more essential war work, and then attended a government training college in Salford. After 6 months of qualifications, or after attaining, receiving them, I was transferred to aircraft manufacture at some of the Fairey aviation plants situated in the Manchester area, mainly in the Ashton and Denton areas, or Tameside, as it is now called. The plant had opened in 1940, and at my date of joining, on the 8th of May 1941, it employed almost 3,000 people, two-thirds of which were on day work and the rest on a permanent night shift. My clock number was 1157. The canteen alone seated over 900 people at one sitting. During our midday mealtime, there was entertainment which comprised radio workers' playtime programmes on the tannoy, which were beamed out to us every weekday, and live ENSA concerts on the first and third Tuesdays of each month. The workers themselves had a band. It wasn't a bad dance band at all. And they went under the name the Ambassadors Band, outside the works. But the works themselves united them with what they called the Northern Concert Party, and that was willing entertainers from the ranks who joined the band at their rehearsals. Now ENSA, who entertained on the first and third Tuesdays of each month, in their rules limited non-union artists only to entertain with their permission. And those of you who have worked at large industrial complexes or on munitions during wartime, we recall that many people would leave the canteen as soon as they had eaten their meals, and this was encouraged to make room for the next sitting, and employees could then return to their workplace and listen to the canteen entertainment over the loudspeaker system in all the departments. One lunchtime in February 1942, on a snowy February day, there was a blizzard, and the ENSA concert party couldn't get through on their motor transport. So our ambassador's concert party were asked to join our band and go ahead on stage in the canteen. Now, I think I told you in my previous memories, but from being a child performer, I have never worn my glasses, my spectacles on stage. When I was a child, they were the small round ones we wore, like bottle glass. Actually, they've come back into fashion nowadays. But when I was small, people would say to me, I should be scared of looking out at all the people in the audience. But what they never knew was that I'd never seen an audience from the stage, because to me it was just like looking out to sea at midnight, and a dark midnight at that. Well, this Tuesday morning, I got on stage, and the canteen was half empty, many of the people already having eaten their meal. And I was doing my parson sketch, and well into it, when I realised that the seats were filling instead of emptying. And before I'd got to the end of it, people were stood round the walls of the canteen, roaring with laughter. Now, the works manager, in his ivory tower in the office, also listened to these concerts, but none of us had ever known until that day, because he himself was aware that the applause and the laughter was getting louder instead of diminishing. And he made arrangements to attend our next charity show the following Sunday evening at the Barcliffe Cinema, Denton. And he arranged afterwards for me to come up to his office the following morning and told me his wife had enjoyed my entertainment very much. And he was going to have me interviewed in Manchester to join EMSA. It seemed as though it was going to be a lease-lend basis. But anyway, after meeting the EMSA people and doing a bit of my stuff, I was seconded to them from the company for 8 months. That only meant that 2 days a week I would appear with them. The rest of the day I would be in the tour room at Northern Aircraft. It meant that I went to many factories with EMSA throughout the Northwest, and also military and Air Force bases. In fact, I went to Wilmslow so often that I always felt at home with the Air Force. One weekend show at Ladysmith Barracks in Ashton-under-Lyne, I was comparing the show, and a very attractive 20-year-old soprano called Margaret Savory, who, by the way, in the 50s went on to join the Carl Rosa Opera Company. But Margaret was a beautiful singer, and when she sang her final number, it was a song, Where or When, a very popular song then in the 40s, and has been recently revived with considerable success. And when we all assembled for the final round of applause, at Margaret's entrance, the lads out front were deafening, shouting for Margaret. And even the officers at the front did nothing to stop them. Eventually, after a few minutes of this, I had to advance to the front and call for hush. And when I did, I got something like it, but hardly enough for me to be heard. But eventually, they quietened down, and so I told them that Margaret had just said she would like to come and sing to them again, at which there was torrential applause. And then I put my hand up, and I said, and she says I can give you her telephone number. Well, the lads went mad. And I said the first number that came into my head, and by then they were all getting up and climbing over the seats. I suppose they were trying to get to the nearest telephone. This information from the boys, as I've told you, got a rousing reception, but it was nothing to the rousing reception I got 2 days later, because I was taken by car from the factory Northern Aircraft up to the adjutant's office at Ladysmith Barracks. He was livid. They'd received irate complaints from the Droyles and Co-op jam and biscuit works. Complaints of jammed switchboards. Well, I stood there and I had to laugh at that, and that made it even worse. And I've always suspected that he was one of them who'd been ringing Margaret. as you would expect, or I at least hope you would expect, the ambassador's band and the Northern Concert Party were kept very busy on the local entertainment front in these years. We had the five-piece band, two vocalists, a ventriloquist, and me. And I did the job of compere and knockabout comedian. And we entertained throughout the Manchester region, Cheshire, at cinemas and charity concerts, and in clubs, schools, and halls of every kind. Whilst at a RAF camp in Wilmslow, we were introduced to the commanding officer of the Ashton Underline ATC, the Air Training Corps, then in its fledgling years as a national youth organisation. And he told me that night that during the forthcoming Ashton Underline Wings for Victory Week, the ATC were hoping to raise funds with a show given by their own ranks, and were looking for a suitable place to get it on a weekday evening. Wings for Victory Weeks were held all over the country, in old towns and villages, to raise money for badly needed heavy bombers needed to attack Germany by night and day. Eventually, I was called into the works manager's office to receive a telephone call from him to say that at last he got suitable premises. And it was what was known in Ashton Underline as the PSA building, but it was actually Ryecroft Street Methodist Church, which was a massive place, but which for years before the war had concentrated on hymn singing every Sunday afternoon, open to anyone, and it was highly successful. He told me that they'd got the cast for the show from their own youth members, and they got our five-piece band. Would I compare the show? I said, of course. Apart from the band, of course, they were all strangers to me. But 3 days before the show, I received a programme and planned my own linking material. In conversations with the drummer of our band at work, whose son was in the ATC, and I think had done a lot of the spade work in getting us there, he thought the show would be all right on the night. And it was, at the start anyway. Ryecroft Methodist Hall, on the corner of Ryecroft Street in Ashton-under-Lyne, holds 1,000 people. And the ATC had done their best to have the rostrum, which is what the pulpit where the choir was on Sunday, more like a stage, with drapes pinned at each end and some coloured bulbs in the lights, and some spotlights overhead. In the front row sat all the officers in uniform and their ladies. Behind them, the ATC parents, the general public and friends in the side seats and the balcony. The members of the ATC and their mates were scattered all over the place, having acted as stewards. Now the first half of the programme went very well, allowing for the extreme youth of most of those appearing. It was an all-male show at that time. The ATC was restricted to boys and men. During the interval, when a raffle was held, well, I should say the tickets were sold, the winners to be announced at the end of the show, then the second half began. And the first act was billed to be a farmer's boy. You all remember, you will all be familiar, sometime or other, with that song, to reap and mow, etc., and be a farmer's boy. I wonder how many of you listening to this tape watched TV on the anniversary in 1995 on television on VE night. On BBC One, there was a typical 1945 concert, Call Up the Stars, and John Inman, well known theatrically today, impersonated the late Frank Randall in his sketch, celebrated for many years, The Old Hiker. At a cue from me, the band struck up To Be a Farmer's Boy. And the farmer's boy walked on stage, a big and brawny character, dressed in more sacking than anything else. He looked shocking. He was a shocking character, dressed in more sacking and with a rake and a stick over his shoulder with a pudding dish tied in a red handkerchief on the end of it, just as though he was going haymaking, and singing, "Oh, to be a farmer's boy," and then relapsed into the Frank Randall act, almost word for word. I'd seen Frank Randall at Manchester a few weekends before, and this lad must have studied it to the life. He was leering at the front rows and winking at the ladies, and he came out with it all. But when he came out with the line, "They better get that lad of yours two chops for his tea, missus. I've heard he's courting." Well, one of the officers rushed up from the front row, calling to me, "Get off, get him off. There's ladies sitting here." To which the farmer's boy replied, "Get yourself off there," and made to continue. There was an uproar at the front, and two or three officers were on their feet. I peered round the drapes, and these officers said to me, "Get the curtain down, he's disgusting. He's disgusting to our ladies." And some of them were leading their ladies out of their seats. I said, "There is no curtain," which there wasn't. And he said to the band, "Can't you play something?" Then some of the other ATC members of the cast came onto the front of the stage from where they'd been hiding behind, saying, "Can't he go on, sir?" It all happened in moments, and it sounds so ridiculous as I sit here remembering it. But then others in the audience took a hand. I don't think it was any ATC members, but it may have been their mates. They started stamping their feet. And at this, the audience started to rise to their feet and file out, the caretaker, with great presence of mind, having opened the main doors. The whole evening descended into chaos, and the officers closed the show, trying to make their voices heard above the row. The band still playing, and feet still stamping. I made my exit backstage by the fire escape, anonymously. And as I went, someone was asking for the police. Through the door, I heard the fire bucket that the ATC lads had been folding all the raffle tickets up in crash to the floor. And I didn't care if I hadn't won either. The local paper reported that an entertainment by members of the Ashton Air Training Corps had raised almost £100 for the Wings for Victory Week, which I suppose was a very good way of describing it. I received a letter of thanks for my services. Eventually, we recruited the farmer's boy into the ambassador's concert party. He is called George Hoff, still lives in Ashton-under-Lyne, and we still keep in touch. We still keep in touch with the boys of the band. They all came to my wedding, and he did the act at our reception, but he allowed my wife and I to go on honeymoon before he revealed just how coarse he could be. Ah well, all's well that ends well, as Shakespeare would have it. In March 1945, the redundancy programmes nationally were set in motion, starting with aircraft production, which meant that by spring in 1945, I was made redundant. Without cash, there was no cash enhancement in those days. But of course, in the intervening years, I had married, and in 1945 we had a little girl, one child, and another one was on the way. In April 1945, the essential work order was still operating, in which anyone who was unemployed had to report to their local employment exchange, either for unemployment pay benefit or a chance of some work. So of course, by then we'd moved back to Ramsbottom from Ashton-under-Lyne, because we'd seen this coming. And I went up to the Labour Exchange, which all during the war years was housed in the Conservative Club on the Marketplace. The staff was a Mr. Balfour and his lady assistant, whose name and age, I think, were unknown to anybody. On presenting my card, they gave me a piece of paper with news of a vacancy on aircraft work at Carnarvon in Wales. Now, we had a second baby on the way, and I'd been working away from home most of the war years. So I expressed a desire, particularly because of the second child, that I would like any vacancy they had locally. The two of them had a whispered conversation out of sight, but you could hear them, but not what they said. And they came back and gave me a green card. That meant that they were offering you a job. Nothing to do with football. And on it was a vacancy for a bus conductor at Ramsbottom Bus Depot. Now, I've always thought that they would think I wouldn't take this job. But I said thanks and reported straight away to the bus depot in Stubbins Lane, was interviewed by the manager, Mr. Parsons, and started there the next morning. I was on 2 weeks' training, regular day work, and spent every morning on the road with some other conductor and a driver, and in the afternoons, learning the fares and timetables, or working in the depot, in the bus depot or shed. Now, on the Monday of the second week, a chap called Joe Shore, who was the shed foreman, told me to go outside and help Joe Taylor and Bob Thompson, two of the men who did all the work on the buses. And I found them cleaning the white tiled pit where they service the bus undercarriages. They were in old overalls, so I was kitted out too. I must have looked a cut. Old overalls, old shoes and an old cloth cap to keep the grease and oil out of our hair. The three of us climbed down into the pit, wiping the walls down with gunk, a grease dispenser, a disperser. Then climbed out and sprayed jets of water onto it until it was cleaned away. Whilst they were down in the depths, Joe Shore passed by, and seeing me, he shouted, "They're not wearing the top hat now." I said to Bob Thompson, "What's he mean?" And Bob replied, "Well, didn't you wear one when you were away at St. Paul's?" Which I hadn't anyway. But some weeks later, Joe Shore was on my bus when I was going home. So in our conversation, I said to him, "Hey, Joe, I didn't wear a top hat at my wedding." And he replied, "Well, what are you talking about?" So I referred to the pit cleaning episode in his remark. And he said, "I were talking about you on stage at our Sunday school years and years ago." And after that, we were the best of friends whilst I was on the buses. But the incident on the buses, which has followed me most of my life, or whenever buses are in the conversation, is as follows. Later in the summer, a terrible thing happened. My wristwatch broke. Not a great catastrophe today, I can hear you think, but then, the shop windows and the shops during those war years were absolutely empty. They had nothing in them. There was nothing to buy. And it was essential to have a watch on the buses, because the conductor, not the driver, he rules the time that you arrive and you leave at all the different stages. So my watch had to go to the mender's, a chap called Bob Bridge in Bolton Street, to be repaired. And I had to rely on the driver's timekeeping. And 2 days after that, climbing out of the cab to go for our breakfast in the depot, he dropped it onto the concrete floor. He dropped his pocket watch. And it stopped. Well, I was going home to breakfast. I lived quite near. And the only portable timepiece that we had was an old alarm clock, one of the American type with 2 bells on the top. So I put that in my case and took it back to the buses. We started off, I placed my case on the luggage rack as usual. And had to lift it down if I wanted to check things, departure times, etc. And everything worked okay until the midday rush from Bury to Edenfield. Now at that time, one inspector of ours was due to retire, and a bus driver had been made probationary. And this lad was very keen to succeed, and eventually did. He boarded our bus at Bury Bridge, and as we left the old Duke pub, it happened. The clock alarm, some way, was triggered off. Imagine it today. You'd have thought the IRA had started something. And the whole bus looked startled, and then apprehensive, and then some. And finally Philip, the new inspector, came shuttling down the bus to me saying, "What's going on?" Whilst I was grappling to get the case off the rack and get my hand in it, it seemed like hours, but it was only second. That's a joke, isn't it? I managed to get my hand inside the case and stop the darn thing. Philip gave me a look, which I'm not going to describe to you, there may be ladies listening, and said, pointing up the bus, "That lady sat there is Mrs. Parsons, the transport manager's wife." And then went down, assuring them all that he had everything under control. I made the best of it, keeping my head down a bit. But you know, you never pick any fares up between the old Duke and Euclid Road, do you? So you've very little to do. And I knew an explanation would be required from me soon enough. As Mrs. Parsons was waiting to alight from the bus, I said to her, I touched the nib of my cap and I said, "I'm sorry, madam, but my wristwatch is broken. And this was the only timepiece I could bring." By the time I was finishing the shift at 2 o'clock, I had already been up in the office with Mr. Parsons and the inspector, and it was all over the bus shed. They told me it was all over Ramsbottom and Bury too. Everybody was laughing about it. But it did me no harm with Mr. Parsons. After smiling about it, when the inspector had gone, he said, "My wife told me all about it over lunch." And he sent for Bob Thompson and arranged for me to borrow a watch until mine was repaired. I hadn't known till then that Bob's nickname was Clock Bob, because he mended them and sold second-hand ones too. But things were never the same with the new inspector. Not when he got the permanent job. In fact, he was always critical and sometimes abusive about the way I did the job. Whoever was my driver, he would never leave us alone, always jumping on to check us about one thing or another. And I found it unsettling. So as soon as the essential work order was taken off in July, I went back to F.T. Sims, back to the enamelled wires game. Now, I didn't stay at Sims very long, but went to a similar factory in Nelson. 4 or 5 years later, I was told by a retired bus driver that I'd done the right thing. He said, "Frank, you were well liked by the travelling public, and because you were popular, several always thought you were letting people ride free, and that's why he was always on your back. But as Esther Ramson once said, folks, that's life." We're passing on now, friends, to 1960. Lots of things lie dormant in your memory, don't they? And are brought to mind by the simplest things. This occurrence in my life concerns a police raid and after hours at a pub. By 1960, I was doing quite a lot of guest speaking at dinners, mainly at men's dinners. And in Oldham, at a licensed vigilers dinner, I always enjoyed those, I made the acquaintance of the manager and his wife of the Holcombe Brook pub, the Hare and Hounds. Now in 1960 and in the 50s, the Holcombe Brook pub, the Hare and Hounds, was fully residential and was hardly the fun pub that we know there today. It was well run, the catering was good, and it was patronised by everyone in the Holcombe Brook area. Well, this evening, the landlord and his wife, who I already knew were living in the area, introduced me to the landlord of the White Lion pub in Bolton Street, Bury. Friends of theirs. And the landlord of the White Lion's son was soon to be married in November. And they'd been arranging his stag night, which was to take place on the Friday before the Saturday wedding. They'd arranged with the people at the Hare and Hounds that there should be a sandwich meal, a buffet meal, made for the bride-to-be, best man, and all the male guests were joining in the stag night, and hoping that it would go hopefully without undue incident, the first part of the evening would be spent in a private room at the Hare and Hounds pub, with concealed supervision, of course, from the landlord and the landlady. When they were leaving the Hare and Hounds, they would be making a grand finale to the evening at Bury Pally. Now you will understand these precautions more when I tell you that the parents' wedding gift to the bridegroom and his bride was an almost new black knife-edged Triumph car, and he would be in it and driving it that night. They knew that if he was inebriated when it was time to leave the Hare and Hounds, that they would be told to come in their car and take him to the pally. And I suppose they thought, and he can walk home from there to home after that. Now you may wonder what I had to do with this. Well, the landlord and the landlady from the Hare and Hounds, I've talked over with them, paying me to be a visiting cleric resident in the Hare and Hounds pub for the evening, and to make contact accidentally, of course, with the wedding party, and to join them at supper in the side room. I wasn't really keen on, I don't mind being on stage, you've got footlights and an audience. I don't mind being at a dinner because there's always something on the table you can throw at them if they get a bit rough. But, they said a fee of £15 and a bed for the night, of course, at the pub, and as much as I could eat and drink, I suppose. Well, £15 was more than I earned in a week. So it made me waver, and then I was on. Yes, I would do it. Well, the Friday evening came. When I entered the bar, I came down the stairs from the private parlour. I could tell that many of the regulars who I knew were in on the joke. So I made my way to the side room and stumbled in saying, I think I've lost my way. Well, the seven lads who were sat there, I've never seen 14 eyes look like it since. They just looked as though they couldn't believe their luck. Crikey, a parson at a stag night. You could almost read their minds. So they made me welcome and handed me a chicken sandwich. But as I declined to be made for wish, they soon returned to behaving and treating me as though I wasn't there. But the prospect of the 15 quid made me think I'm going to slug this out. They offered me sherry, which I drank. I mean, that's the parson's, it's the parson's penance, is that. You get inured to it. But I made sure it was 1-1, and they were all on bitter. And the landlord was coming in with trays of drinks for them, you know, and giving me a wink when he could. I ate quite a few sandwiches to mop up the sherry. And the best man became more confiding. I would say after about 20 minutes, and he'd have 3 pints of bitter because the landlord had been on 3 times. he told me that the bridegroom was his mate and they were good mates. But the bridegroom and the bride hadn't left anything to chance, because with the bride's encouragement, he managed to get the key to her dad's caravan once or twice up on Turton Road, he said. They dispensed with anticipation, I said, of the wedding evening that night. And he said, yes, and tomorrow's the consequence. I thought, you're some mate. Then he said, should she really wear white? Now, I really can't recall my reaction to this at all. Except he asked me then, have you ever gone caravanning? And I replied, do you and the chief bridesmaid go caravanning? And then he said, I think you must have knocked about a bit for a parson. Now, by then, it was 10:15. And the party was leaving. Remember that these were the days of 10:30 closing for all pubs. And the bridegroom, slobbering over me, invited me to the church. He said, my mother will never believe me if you don't come. But by 10:45, the bars were cleared, not the pub. The regular night shift had already ensconced in the vault bar, which is now the games room facing the front. I removed my clerical collar and joined them. They'd been told all about it by then. The landlord brought me a large gin. He mentioned something about sweat. I mentioned the 15 pounds. He said, that's what I mean, mind your sweat. I said, I've done all that in there. Then he brought me a gin, made a pleasant change from sherry. And then he came over with another large gin and 15 pounds. I was ready to go then. I thought, I'm not going to spend here upstairs, spend the 15 pounds as well. And I got chatting to a chap, quite a nice conversation for about 10 minutes, and all at once the landlady called, hush! She was peering through the front window. There was a car pulling up outside. She said, it's the bridegroom back. Well, I rushed into the lounge to get my collar on. And turning to retrace my steps, I froze, because coming through the revolving doors at the front of the pub there, I could see a flat police cap. And the mouth under the cap opened and said, are you staying here, sir? I nodded. My knees were weak. I And the mouth continued, "Well, don't you think it's time you were in bed, sir?" I nodded again. I couldn't speak. But then adrenaline flowed in my veins and I straightened up, and reserves of strength and confidence returned, and I said, "Sure, and it's feather to thee too." Two fingers touched there and then of that black cap. And I turned towards the stairs and went up and sat on the top one, out of sight. It seemed like eternity, but it was only 40 minutes, whilst the chap I'd been sat with downstairs got booked for my gin. And as soon as the police cars went, so did I. I went into my bedroom and went to bed. The following January, I was producing the pantomime Jack and the Beanstalk for St. Philip Stubbins. I did this 3 or 4 years in succession. And the Berwick police were contacted because I wanted the loan of a police uniform for a sketch. And the vicar and I went to collect it. And the young officer who was on duty wasn't wearing his flat cap that night. But I'd seen that face before. And so I turned round and came out and got to the vicar's car. Because I'm sure that if I hadn't been accompanied by the genuine article, he'd have had me. That young officer's suspicions would have been proved correct. The following year, 1961, St. Philip's Church in Stubbins and I decided that the pantomime should be Red Riding Hood. Of course, all the rehearsals took place in the autumn months, and in wintertime, Chatterton Lane is not the ideal location, but particularly when there's no bus service that runs down it, and not many people had cars in that time. However, we prepared for the worst, and New Year's Day fell on Wednesday in 1962, and the pantomime was to be given on the night of New Year's night, and the following three nights, Saturday the 4th, Wednesday the 8th, and Saturday the 11th. But we soon realised, on New Year's Day, when we were having the final rehearsal, that response from the public was going to be such that we should need additional chairs, which we had to borrow from St. John's Shuttleworth, who hadn't gotten anything on New Year's Day. And the show went so well on New Year's Day, we realised that we would spot an even further show, a further performance, which would mean that it would be being given five times. There were crowded houses each night, and I must admit, it was a good pantomime, because Red Riding Hood has such a good story, and there's everything in it, really. And it's very difficult to do, so that's why it isn't done very often. Regardless of snowdrifts and ice, people came from as far as Wigan to see it. And a lot of them stood at all the five performances. Now, the comedy was supplied by Grandma Simple Simon and Idle Jack, plus a female who was a natural comedian on stage, a member of the church choir, the Hilda Baker type. You know, there's nothing like a church pantomime for bringing people together, thrilling old and young, learning their lines, funny, downright daft, some of them, but having a good sing, being stars, if only for 10 minutes. Well, maybe for a couple of hours. And after four packed houses, the final performance came. All the press reports had been complimentary, and people were still standing in the aisles. We gathered on stage for the prayer of the vicar before the opening curtain. And the vicar announced, first of all, that he had received some complaints about the show. He said it was one of the songs and would have to be omitted from this particular evening's performance. After the prayer, the cast having dispersed, I asked what song. And he told me it was, "Oh dear, what can the matter be?" I asked what complaints, but he wouldn't give me those. He wouldn't give me any details. He just said, "Cancel it, Frank." Now, as the song was in the last act, I informed the comedy trio of the decision with which they demurred. In fact, the dame, who was the church secretary, refused to omit it. It was just as though the roof had fallen in. I passed the note to the church warden's wife, who was playing the piano, to tell her of the deletion. And during the interval, I sensed backstage that something was being cooked up by members of the cast. So as the time came when the song would be sung, I stepped onto the stage and said that the next song was being deleted by request. Uproar from the kids at the front, because, you know, most of them in the village had been there every night. They could have said a lot of the script. In fact, they did quite often, of course, hilarity. And some started to sing, "Oh dear," etc. But they were soon shushed. And the final performance ended to enthusiastic applause, and that, I thought, was the end of it. Till Tuesday morning of the following week. Before 8:30, reporters were asking for me at my place of work, at the office, and waiting for me to turn up. It was the Bury Times reporters and Rosenblum Free Press. They'd been tipped off about the song on Sunday, about the rude song, by one of the cast, who'd given them his copy. Already they'd visited the vicarage, and the vicar had declined to comment. So did I. By Wednesday, a telephone call from Rosenthal Free Press informed me that the vicar had been interviewed and had told them that objections by parents of children singing the song at home were the reason. I told them I had nothing to add except that I would send them a copy of the song, but there was nothing salacious or offensive in the show, and the show had been an unqualified success, and in 25 years of producing children's concerts, nothing like this had ever happened, and I thought it was being done to embarrass members of the church and the clergy. Friday's Bury Times ran a double column. The dame, the church secretary, had resigned. Headlines in the Bury Times News, also the Daily Express, the News of the World, the Daily Mail, the Daily Mirror. Sources on Church Panto. Church officer resigns. On Channel 4, the local ITV News ran the story. The Daily Herald rang the vicar, promising them a donation to church or charity for a news item. And the cast, all anti-censorship and pro-song, wanted to hire the Civic Hall and do another Bookshee performance. People rang my office, rang us at home, waiting to cash in some way on the publicity. The plans to take excerpts of the pantomime ran to hospitals, which we did every year, were cancelled. We thought it best to let it die down. Despite this obnoxious song, record profits and taking were accepted gratefully by the church authorities. The Catholic Church in Earlham rang me and asked me to produce their next Christmas pantomime and name my own fee. Bolton Road Methodist Church in Bury asked me to take over their pantomime. Their producer had just been rushed into hospital. The drummer with our band at St. Philip's got signed up for Butlin's Fiery Summer Season, and they told him he could take me. Friends, I have directed many shows since, but I've never done another pantomime. Thank you for listening.